Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to go over Psalms 39 with you. I will call this psalm, What is the Measure of My Days? Now, the heading of the psalm says this, For the director of music, for Jeduthun, a psalm of David. So we once again know that we're still talking about Davidic psalms as we have been all the way from Psalm 2 to Psalm 39 here. The heading says the psalm is for the director of music, i.e. the choir master, and it was for Jeduthun. Well, who was Jeduthun? Well, he was one of the chief singers working at David's tabernacle. Actually, it was Moses' tabernacle while the tabernacle was up at Gibeon. During the reign of David, we read in 1 Chronicles 16, 41 through 42, with them being Zadok and the priest at Gibeon, who were managing Moses' tabernacle, with them were Heman and Jeduthun, and the rest who were chosen, who were designated by name to give thanks to the Lord, because his loving kindness is everlasting. And with them were Heman and Jeduthun, with trumpets and cymbals for those who should sound aloud, and with instruments for the songs of God, and the sons of Jeduthun for the gate. So we see that Jeduthun was probably a Levite whose forte was music. Now David starts this psalm in verse 1 by saying, I said, I will guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. Now David is just speaking to a general audience here. He's not really directing his words to the Lord here. He wants to not sin with his tongue. What does David mean by this? Well, he could be saying that I will guard my mouth and will not sin with my tongue so that I do not sin against God. He could mean that, but Adam Clark suggests that what David means here is that David does not want to sin with his tongue by giving David's enemies a cause to speak evil of God. The idea being that David is trapped by wicked people that are in his presence. He gets angry at them. He says something that is either unsupportable or causes wrath or something. Because David represents Yahweh. He is the man after God's own heart. And if he presents himself unfavorably to his enemies, that's going to redound to God's discredit. And so David says, I'm going to keep my mouth shut. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle. A muzzle, of course, is what keeps the ox from eating grain. A muzzle on a horse, muzzle on an ox. Of course, this is great application for talking about sins with the tongue. I can picture doing a Bible teaching on the book of James, talking about the tongue as a flame of fire. And this is a good place to go to right here. David says, I'm not going to sin with my tongue. Because folks, as I've said many, many times before, that old refrain, sticks and stones can hurt my bones, but words can never hurt me, is not true, because people who use evil words against you are sinning with their tongue, and we all need to guard our mouths as with a muzzle. So David refers to the wicked who are in his presence, during which time David will guard his mouth as with a muzzle. Well, the wicked people are there. They're wanting to attack David, but it's hard for your enemies to attack your words if there are no words to attack. So just be quiet. You remember when Jesus, when he was arrested, he did defend himself a little bit, but when it became more and more obvious that he was in front of kangaroo courts, he just shut up, just looked at them while they made their ridiculous and slanderous attacks on him and blasphemous attacks on him. Now, this brings up a problem in my mind. I was in the presence of the enemies of Christ all my academic career because the college campuses are not friendly to Christianity, of course, and then most of my academic career was in China where they're really not friendly with Christians. And I was constantly facing the conundrum, do I speak or do I not speak? Because I wanted to witness to people, my chance in China. And every underground missionary in China had different standards on that. I heard the story of one teacher, foreign teacher, who just got up in his class and witnessed to the whole class. Of course, he didn't last long. He was arrested and booted out of the country. They give you 48 hours to pack your bags, get a visa, and go, and get a plane ticket and go. Very expensive, very inconvenient. So I came to this conclusion. I would never say anything about Christ in class. But then when I had students that were alone outside of class, and I was friends with them, then I would speak to them. And I found that very effective. I finally got nailed after 23 years. They didn't actually kick me out of the country. They just kicked me out of my job. But most of the time, I guarded my mouth as with a muzzle when the wicked were were in my presence, because if I didn't, I would get nailed. And David did the same thing. But on the other hand, you don't want to muzzle yourself so much that you never witness. It's a hard problem. David said, I was mute and silent in verse 2. I, David, refrained even from good. Well, what does that mean, he refrained from good? Why would anybody want to refrain from good? Well, there's a couple of options here. David could be saying, not only did I not speak bad things about my enemies because my sin was muted in my mouth and my mouth was muzzled, I didn't speak bad things about my enemies, but I didn't even speak good things about them. I just stood there quiet. Now notice verse 2 doesn't say that David refrained even from speaking good. It just says he refrained even from good. The speaking would have to be implied, and in fact, the Holman Christian Study Bible so does imply. The HCSB translation says, I was speechless and quiet. I kept silent even from speaking good. And the speaking's in brackets to show that it's not in the original text. So that's one way of interpreting this refraining from good that David did. He just didn't say anything, good or bad, about his enemies. But another way of reading that verse is to say that David was so convinced of the rightness of his cause, he wasn't going to defend himself. In other words, when his enemies were in his presence, the wicked, they were attacking him, and he says, okay, I'm not going to defend myself. You're a kangaroo court. I think that's the proper way to read that. And then in verse 3, David says, my heart was hot within me. He had passion, he had anger, he had resentment at his enemies who were saying all kinds of bad stuff about him. And that's what happens when you have strong emotions that are pent up by silence. He's listening, he's not speaking, he can't say anything. He's getting madder and madder, more angry and more angry within his heart. While he was musing, he thought about what his enemies were saying. The fire burned in his chest, and then he spoke with his tongue. Now, I'm assuming that the heat within David was because of his anger at his enemies. It could have been, as John Gill suggests, that the heat came from his zeal for God. Either way, those two ideas are closely related. If you have zeal for God, you're going to hate God's enemies. For whatever reason, David finally speaks. Now, notice in verse 1, he made a resolution that he would not speak. He would guard his mouth as with a muzzle. Two verses later, he is speaking. So how do we explain that? Adam Clark says this, quote, it is a hard thing to be denied the benefit of complaint and sufferings, as it has a tendency to relieve the mind, and indeed in some sort to call off the attention from the place of actual suffering. And yet undue and extravagant complaining enervates the mind, makes it weak, so that it becomes a double prey to its sufferings. On both sides there are extremes. David seems to have steered clear of them on the right hand and on the left. In other words, if you get mad and start popping off at your enemies, that's not smart. But on the other hand, sometimes you need to speak up to defend yourself. It makes you feel better. I notice in all these true crime movies, when the bad guy has the poor, innocent victim at his mercy, and sometimes the innocent victim starts mocking his accuser. And I say, no, 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 don't do that. It's going to make him angry. He might shoot and kill you. He might slap you in the head. It doesn't do any good. But they do that because it makes them feel better so that they can taunt the evil, wicked person who is oppressing them. All right, so David is speaking with his tongue in verse 3. Let's see what he says in verses 4 through 6. David says this, Lord, make me to know my end and what is the extent of my days. Let me know how transient I am. Behold, you have made my days as handbreadths and my lifetime as nothing in your sight. Surely every man at his best is a mere breath, Selah. Surely every man walks about as a phantom. Surely they make an uproar for nothing. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. So David, having had the heat build up in his chest, he finally lets out, but he's not speaking to his enemies, he's speaking to God, because he says, Lord, make me to know my end. And of course, all of this is occasioned by being surrounded by his wicked enemies, and so that's the connection between verses 1, 2, 3 and verses 4, 5, and 6. David is asking God to make me know my end. In other words, how long am I going to have to put up with these evil oppressors? Adam Clark agrees with that. He says David wanted to know how much longer he had to suffer. And so David blurts out in pain here, let me know my end. What is the extent of my days? Let me know how transient I am. David is feeling transient because he's being oppressed. And of course, everyone feels the shortness of life at one time or another, even when you're Generation Z. Maybe they don't, but most normal people do. We see that sentiment expressed in Psalms 102, verse 11, the author of which is unknown. The psalmist says, "There my days are like a lengthened shadow, and I wither away like grass." Shadows are pretty transient. Grass is pretty transient. It withers. Unfortunately, the grass at my house doesn't wither, and I have to cut it every other day. If the sun would just hit it, though, it'll wither. Job 14, verse 5. This is Job speaking. He says this, since a man's days are determined, the number of his months is with you, God, and his limits you have set, God, so that he, man, cannot pass. So we are not eternal. I mean, that should be a truism. But sometimes we forget how transient we are, and David wants to be reminded. He wants to be reminded so he knows that he won't have to put up with this garbage from his wicked oppressors eternally. And David continues with a thought in verse 5, "You have made my days as handbreadths." A handbreadth is pretty skinny. Not very long if you go from top to the bottom of your hand, and that's the idea, your days are short. "My lifetime is nothing in your sight." Ooh, that's really short. Nothing. "Surely every man at his best is a mere breath." Well, how transient is your breath? You breathe out when it's cold, you look at the fog, and boom, it's gone. David continues in verse 6, "Surely every man walks about as a phantom. Every man is a ghost." We're walking dead, folks. We're zombies. "Surely they," that means the wicked, "make an uproar for nothing." Oh, they make a lot of uproar. Read the news. Read the internet. All the entertainment people and all the athletes making millions of dollars. It's all for nothing. David continues, "The wicked amasses riches and does not know who will gather them." Now, Clark and Gill say that this is an agricultural metaphor. The idea is that a farmer is planting his crops, cultivating his field, getting rid of the weeds, planting the crops. Then he cuts the crops, puts them in haystacks on the field, and then croaks. He dies, the farmer does, and somebody else has to gather all of that wheat and put it into the granary and winnow it and so forth, prepare it for eating and cooking. But the guy who worked so hard on the farm to get the wheat grown, he doesn't get to participate in all that. He doesn't know who will gather the wheat. Well, that very well could be, but it seems to me you could just refer this to the passing of wealth after one dies. He amasses riches and does not know who will gather them. Oh, you can write a will, but how many times are wills contested? I remember when I was practicing law, I used to love it when people would come in and talk about wills, and I finally decided, you know, these rich people in my hometown, some of whom I knew, or knew them by reputation anyway, because they were wealthy, they die, and then all the vultures come circling around the corpse. I want my money. The love of riches is the root of all evil. And basically David is saying here in verse 6, you can't take it with you when you go. So why are you making so much noise trying to make money all the time, wicked people? We go now to Psalms 39, verses 7 through 11. David is still speaking to God, and he says, "And now, Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in you. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. I have become mute. I do not open my mouth, because it is you who have done it. Remove your plague from me, because of the opposition of your hand I am perishing. With reproofs you chasten a man for iniquity. You consume as a moth what is precious to him. Surely every man is a mere breath." Selah. Now, David moves in verses 7 through 11 from the opposition of evil people to him, to his royal self. Now he's talking about the opposition of God to David. Why? Because David has sinned. One more example of a penitential psalm in which David does not express self-righteousness. You know, that's always the problem, as I said in chapter 1 of Psalms, the problem of self-righteousness in the Psalms. Well, David's not acting very self-righteous here. When he does say he's righteous, he just means he's not guilty of whatever his enemies are charging him with. He's not saying that he is sinlessly perfect like Adam was before Adam and Eve ate the fruit. So in verse 7, David says, "And now, Lord, for what do I wait?" And of course, wait is not waiting at a train station for a train. It's wait with confident expectation, with laser-like focus on what is coming. In other words, God's deliverance. He's focused on that. "My hope is in you." He says in verse 8, deliver me from all my transgressions. And here's where he's admitted that he sinned somehow. And it was David's sins who were causing the opposition from all of his wicked enemies who surrounded him. And so when David is saying, deliver me from all my transgressions, he's saying, God, deliver me from my sins, because that will also be a deliverance from my enemies. My sins have caused my troubles here. I didn't mention who might this be, these enemies. I skipped this. Well, it could be Absalom and David's former advisor Ahithophel, who conspired together to almost deprive David of his throne in Absalom's conspiracy. And remember also Shimei cursing David as he climbed up the Mount of Olives on his way out of Jerusalem. I think that makes a lot of sense. It's a speculation as to who his enemies are, but the point is David is saying, the reason I have all this is because of my transgressions. And it was. He didn't rebuke Absalom when Absalom killed his brother Amon, because his half-brother Amon, because Amon wouldn't let Absalom have sex with Amon's sister Tamar. David screwed up. And then his enemies surrounded him because of his weak kingship. And I think that's probably what he's talking about here in this psalm. In verse 9, David says, I have become mute. I do not open my mouth because it is you who have done it. In other words, his mouth is mute and speaking to God now, not his enemies. He doesn't say anything to God, saying, God, it's not really fair that you're doing this. You shouldn't do this to me. I'm your servant. I'm a man after your own hearts. No, he knows that he's taking his punishment like a man because he deserves it. God, of course, was not the author of David's sin, but he was the author of the punishment for David's sin, as John Gill says. And so when David says, it is you who have done it, he's not saying, it is you who have caused me to sin, of course. He's saying, it is you who are punishing me. In verse 10, David says, remove your plague from me. Did God physically hurt David by putting a plague on David? Probably not. The NIV Study Bible says David in his pain overstated his case against God. Quote, just because David blamed God for his suffering doesn't mean that God mistreated him. Those in agony, whether from physical or emotional pain, often lash out at those closest to them. This apparently was the case with David. And besides, the word plague can be translated otherwise. For example, the KJV says, stroke, remove your stroke from me. The NIV says, scourge, remove your scourge from me. Quit whipping me. And of course, that's metaphorical. God's not whipping David. That might be true. David is speaking figuratively here, but that doesn't mean that David overstated his case against God, because God's punishment was very severe. Might not have been an actual plague or an actual whipping. You can be punished by God without being struck with a plague, and it's not pleasant. Ask anyone who's ever sinned, felt bad about it. It's awful. David says he's dying because of the opposition of your hand. God, I am perishing. I'm dying because of your punishment. So whether it's a physical plague or not, or just internal spiritual torment, David is dying from it. But even though David's sins were severe, thus evoking this severe punishment, despite the terrible punishment that David was receiving, he did turn to God for mercy. In verse 8, he says, God, deliver me from all my transgressions. He didn't run from God and say, it's not fair, God, and then fight against God and try to get out of his punishment. He didn't do that. He was in pain, but David didn't blame God for anything. And in fact, David is seen here to love God very, very much. And we can see that as we go to the last two verses in this psalm. Psalms 39, verses 12 through 13, David says this, hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with you, a sojourner like all my fathers. Turn your gaze away from me, that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. Now you see, David is asking for forgiveness here. He's crying. Do not be silent at my tears, he says. Listen to my cry, O God. So he's still with the Lord, asking for forgiveness. But he feels like a stranger. He says, I am a stranger with you, a sojourner like all my fathers. Now, a sojourner is an alien who is in another person's country. I was a sojourner in China for 23 years, and you're a little bit different when you're a sojourner, an alien, a foreigner, as we were called in China, in English translation, foreign devils, except they didn't use that term anymore, yangguizi. I used to use it to get them, watch Chinese people get uncomfortable. Oh, he's using a terribly offensive term about foreigners. He's using it about himself. He must not know what he's doing. I knew what I was doing. I was having fun. But anyway, David feels like a sojourner. How is that? He's living in the promised land, the land of Israel, the land given by Yahweh, Well, it's because David's real home is in heaven, where God is, and now Canaan seems like a foreign land to David. He's walking around in the promised land feeling like a sojourner in his own promised land. Why? Because he sinned, and his sin has separated him from God. So even in the promised land, David is a sojourner because his real home is in heaven. David says he's a sojourner like all my fathers. Of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were wandering around in the land of Canaan. They didn't own the property. They just wandered, living a nomadic existence before they finally, as time went on, well, after when it got down to Moses and he ran all the Canaanites out, or a lot of the Canaanites out, so that the Israelites had the land actually not as sojourners, but as possessors. But that took a while. So David says he feels like the fathers, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, like the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Verse 13, David says, turn your gaze away from me. He's talking to God now. God, turn your gaze away from me that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. Why would David want God to look away from him? Simple answer to that is because God's gaze was fiery, wrathful, penetrating, and angry. David wanted God to stop chastising him. He didn't want God to turn his gaze away and ignore him and leave him. He wanted the chastisement to stop. He obviously didn't want God to leave him because he said in verse 12, hear my prayer, O Lord, give ear to my cry. So he's not asking God to leave him. He's asking God to stop punishing him. Turn your gaze away from me that I may smile again before I depart. He means depart the land of the living. In other words, before I die, before I am no more, i.e. before I am dead. That's a sad ending to this psalm, and this is one of the few Davidic psalms where David does not end up on a high note. Stop punishing me, God, before I die. I want to smile again before I die. On that sad note, we are now prepared to go to Psalms 40 in our next audio, in which David will say that God is my help and my deliverer. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.